Workforce Development to order. A couple of things as we get started. Work session on Senate Bill 167 will not take place today. There's another amendment that is not finished yet. So if you're here for 167, we will not be doing that today. We're going to go a little out of order because we have some personal issues that need to be attended to by some people in the audience, and we're going to respect that. So we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 451 and ask Senator Ben Westland to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Ben Westland, Senate District 27, and thank you not only for agreeing to hear this bill, but to accommodate the schedule for Mr. Lendon's service. As you may know, my district includes Bend and all of Deschutes County, and as I'm also sure you're aware, our economic reliance on natural resources has dwindled to next to nil. But creative companies have emerged to fill new niches and create a vibrant economy. Bend Distillery is one such example of this new industry. Bend Distillery is reviving the tradition of handcrafted character of small batch American distilled spirits. They use only the freshest natural ingredients, including our very own high desert juniper. They have won numerous awards for their products, too many to mention here, but a few are, and this is really quite impressive. With their Crater Lake vodka, they've won top five in the world. The Hazelnut Espresso, best flavored vodka in the world. The Cascade Mountain Gin, best rated gin in the world. And I'm sure all of your personal favorites, the Mazama Hot Pot Pepper vodka, number one best flavored vodka in the world. While wineries and breweries have been recognized as a driving economic engine for Oregon, craft distillers serve the same distinction and deserve the same recognition and opportunities. This is not just a bill to create jobs and economic opportunity. It's an equity issue as well. Oregon law allows beer brewers and wineries to operate alcohol-making equipment and restaurants at the same site. There is no such explicit provision for distilleries. When I first met with Mr. Dietrich several months ago and heard how they were being limited in ways similar to businesses, weren't, I resolved to help and have enlisted the help of Chuck Burley, who I hope will be showing up here directly. Allowing distilleries to have the same exemption that wineries and breweries enjoy will help build these companies and allow them to participate in our tourism industry. I'll let my constituents go into greater detail as to the specifics of the legislation, but for me, this is simply an issue of economic fairness, and this legislation helps to brand Oregon as a state that produces world-class products and broadens our burgeoning tourist base. Thank you, committee members. I'll leave you in the good hands of Mr. Bendis, the founder and CEO, and Alan Dietrich, the general manager, and the general manager of Bend Distillery. I do have to scoot as quickly as possible to Bill's service, but I'd be happy to answer a few questions if you have any.
That's okay. Thank you very much. Drive safely. Jim and Alan, if you'd like to come forward, please.
They're not as mean as they look. Real good.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Bendis, and I'm the founder and CEO of Bend Distillery. For the record, I reside at 69 Newport Avenue in Bend, Oregon, and I'd like to speak in support of Senate Bill 451. I'd like to give you a little introduction. The growth of the Oregon small batch spirits industry is very similar to 20 years ago when there was a growth of the small brewery industry, which you know as an Oregon tradition has become very well known in the nation as some of the finest breweries in the nation and in the world. Hopefully with a little foresight, we started our micro distillery 11 years ago and have since grown to like Senator Weston said, some of the finest awards. They're just like basically unbelievable that a small batch distillery in Bend, Oregon has been chosen by some of the most renowned international spirits competitions as we're winning some awards that, I mean, I look at them and they blow me away. But I don't want you to think this is the Bend Distillery Bill, because now, just like the micro brewery industry, the micro distillery industry is kind of seeing a little bit of our lead, seeing the trends, and there are probably more than 10 new micro distilleries starting up in Oregon. Similar ones, Hood River Distillery is a very large distillery, but they got into the Pendleton whiskey, and they're taking the micro distillery approach to some of their products. This bill would benefit them, as well as Indio Spirits, House Spirits, Midioff Vodka, Rogue Distillery, Liquid Vodka, and New Deal Distillery. All the latter, except Rogue, have only been around within the last couple years. We started 11 years ago, and started just the distillery, and about 6 years ago, we reviewed the Oregon law and decided to open up a sampling room. And we got approval from the OLCC to operate a sampling room, but really it came under a weird, twisted, underneath a brewery license where we could operate a sampling room. Members of the OLCC basically saw how well we were doing in Little Bend, Oregon, and decided that really what we need to do is to have a full-on Class A restaurant license, because as a sampling room, they wanted to make sure we were offering enough food to accommodate the number of people that were coming to our sampling room. Then just about a year ago, we decided to open a second location. And what happened was that the administration that was with the OLCC before is not the current administration, and interpretation on the laws weren't that clear. So it seemed to be the best thing is to just create a whole separate category for distilleries that's just like the one for wineries, just like the one for breweries. It's probably pretty simple. Good example is over in Idaho. They have this in existence already. There's Bardenay, which is a micro distillery, a distillery pub, and they do quite well, and it's everybody follows the law, we pay taxes, the same thing we're normally doing. One other thing that I think is of good benefit is Oregon's reputation overall in these types of products, breweries, coffee, spirits is another category. When I started micro distilling, I had originally thought of having another micro distillery in Colorado, and thought, okay, well, I can duplicate this. That the Oregon people will like Oregon products, the Colorado people will like Colorado products. Come to find out from doing a lot of surveys that actually the Colorado people would rather have Oregon products because Oregon's name is so well known with natural industry, and that's what we are as a natural industry using. Like in Bend, we're using the natural juniper. Juniper is what makes gin gin, and we use an all-natural juniper. So what we're just trying to do is to create fairness and just be able to have a restaurant license along with our distillery so that people can actually see what's going on and help invent our tourist industry as well. Well, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Why don't we go to testimony, the next, and we'll see if there are.
My name is Alan Dietrich. I am currently the owner of the Old Mill Martini Bar, and for 5 years, the sales manager for Bend Distillery. When I started in 2001 with Bend Distillery, as Jim mentioned, there were maybe 8 or 10 small. When I started in 2001, we were the only small distillery really doing what we were doing. Now, today, there may be 8 or 10 small distilleries fighting for the market share. If we were to go back 25 years ago, as Jim mentioned, there may have been only half a dozen small breweries in Oregon. And today, they account for about $2.25 billion to the Oregon economy. 3,800 workers work for the microbrew industry, and an average salary of $36,000 a year. It's a significant portion of our state's economy. And the wineries similarly contribute about $1.5 billion to our economy. Not to say that we're going to do that with distilleries, but a bill like this would give us a chance to overcome a lot of the traditional hurdles for the small companies in the liquor business, and the fact that mass consumer advertising is typically the way the large national brands reach the consumer, something that is out of our reach. And a bill like this, or the ability to have a sampling room, would allow us to reach the consumer in a much more economical manner. And we've hoped that this bill is written broad enough to benefit all of us. As my current position as the owner of the Old Mill Martini Bar, we have specialized in Oregon products, and we have a menu that's complete from our wine list, our beer list, certainly our spirits, and all of our food is as local as we can get. And given the tourist ride we get through Bend, it's amazing the response we get from people all over the country that is the one thing they seek out the most when they come to the Northwest, is to experience the reputation that they've heard about as how we do things so differently and so well. Whether it's the Oregon Pinots, the craft breweries, and now we're turning them on to the small batch spirits that are available to us. That said, again, a bill like this would really benefit the entire industry, and I feel would allow the OLCC, which I've seen have a little bit of trouble governing us, given laws written strictly for the wineries and the breweries, would allow to govern us a little more fairly, a little more equitably, and make their job easier. Again, as I said, thank you for the opportunity to testify here, and we're both available for questions.
Thank you, Alan. Now, the bill seems to indicate that you will be paying the taxes at the location through the bottled distilled liquor that will be taken care of at site. I mean, it has gone through the commission process.
Yes, currently we pay our taxes weekly to the OLCC for any product that is sold out of our sampling room, and so the structure is already there. We would just continue like that.
Okay. Questions for the committee? Senator Amanda Sanderson.
I don't really have a question because I really think this is a fair bill and I do believe in equity, but I have to put my purist nurse hat on. And I know that the a hard liquor consumption is actually increasing at a greater rate than wine or beer, from what I've heard. And I read that somewhere, so I don't know that as a fact. But I'm just hoping, because hard liquor has a greater impact on the physical body than beer or wine, that you... I'm sure you are, but show due diligence in not having people over imbibe.
Our theory, yeah, I mean, my personal theory is that we attract a person that would rather have one good martini instead of somebody who would go down the street to a cheap place that would like to have two or three bad martinis. Our spirits are not cheap. They are higher quality. We don't attract the people that typically over drink.
Thank you.
Have you seen their prices?
You have a question, Senator Decker.
I've seen their prices.
Been taste testing.
Can you address the amendment that we have before us, 451-1?
Yes, I can just basically on the first paragraph of the amendment, that just basically covers the fact that we will, places like ours, will fully be governed under a Class A restaurant license. So we're not really a sampling room. We're full Class A license, and we'll be required to cover the amount of food items that would help prevent people from over-drinking in a place where you could just get a sample with no food. So what that first paragraph says is that we can be sold under the full on-premise sales license, which better protects people from over-drinking, making sure that we have enough, that companies like ours have enough food available. And then basically the next sections just take out the way we were able to get our license under the brewery. It just takes it all out so that it's simplified under the new bill.
Questions at this moment?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I guess the only question I have is that Section 1 and 2 of the original bill are modified by Section 3, saying that's as it relates to the effective date of Sections 1 and 2. Section 4 doesn't appear to have an effective date. Is that just assumed it'll become effective at the end of this year? Because the way the amendment reads, it's tacked on after line 24. So Section 3 would only still apply to Sections 1 and 2. I'm just curious to know the effective date of Section 4.
My assumption would be if there's no reference, then it would take place on the statutory date.
So then the question,
January 1.
So then the question, is there a situation that would arise that the first two sections of the bill would become effective at a different time than Section 4, and is that a problem? I don't know that it is.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Once you step down, we may have some questions. Donna Vandal, if I mispronounced it, let me know the correct one, from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Donna Vandal. I'm the Technical Services Coordinator for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission's Administrative Policy and Process Division. As you've heard, Senate Bill 451 would allow distilleries licensed in Oregon to provide sample tastings of their products and to sell distilled spirits and other alcoholic beverages by the drink at their distillery premises and at one other additional location. The commissioners of the OLCC have not yet taken a formal position on this bill, so I'm not testifying either in support of or in opposition to the bill, but wanted to address a couple of issues of concern to the OLCC. The OLCC's primary concern was that the bill as it was originally proposed would allow a distillery to sell distilled spirits by the drink without being subject to the requirements that apply to all other licensees who sell distilled spirits for on-premises consumption. These include the food service requirements that are imposed under the Oregon Constitution and the requirement to have liquor liability insurance as set by statute. We believe that these concerns are addressed by the proposed amendments to the bill that we received today. Oregon's tied house laws prohibit a manufacturer, such as a distillery, from selling alcohol to consumers at retail. And as has been pointed out, a number of exceptions to this general rule have been enacted over time. For example, wineries are permitted to have tastings at their premises and at another location, and breweries are permitted to sell beer to consumers at the brewery location. And this bill would create a tied house exception for distilleries as well. However, the sale of distilled spirits is fundamentally different from the sale of beer and wine, because under the Oregon Constitution, distilled spirits may be sold by the drink only where food is cooked and served. This bill in its original form did not incorporate that constitutional requirement for distilleries. In addition, all licensees who sell alcohol for on-premises consumption are currently required by statute to have liquor liability insurance, and the bill did not require this of distillery licensees. As I mentioned, we believe that the proposed amendments to the bill that we received today will address these concerns. The proposed amendments would allow distilleries to obtain a separate license, which is the full on-premises sales license, in order to sell distilled spirits by the drink, instead of granting those privileges under the distillery license itself. Distilleries would be allowed to obtain this full on-premises sales license at their distillery location and at one other location. By obtaining the appropriate licenses for these on-premises sales, the distilleries would be subject to the food service and liquor liability and other requirements that apply to all other on-premises licensees that sell distilled spirits. They will also be required to obtain the distilled spirits sold to consumers from the OLCC, like all other licensees who sell distilled spirits by the drink. Under current law, only distilleries that sell brandy or pot distilled liquor are permitted to provide tastings at their distilleries and to obtain a license to sell distilled spirits by the drink, and this bill will expand those opportunities to all distilleries licensed in Oregon. However, I just wanted to point out that the bill does not limit the tastings to products made at the Oregon licensed premises, nor does it contain any limitation on the types of alcoholic beverage products that can be sold at retail. This means that a distillery is not limited to sampling or selling only products made on the licensed premises or even products that are manufactured in Oregon. I'd also like to point out that there are separate federal requirements that apply to distilleries where on-premises consumption is allowed, including a requirement that the eating and drinking areas be physically separated from the areas where distilled spirits are manufactured. And this is in addition to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission's licensing requirements. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Vandal? Yes, Senator Juana Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are breweries allowed to sell other kinds of products that they have not produced on site? And do wine, what do you call it, wine making places?
Wineries, yes.
Wineries.
Chairman Metzger, Senator Anderson, it is possible for those entities to obtain the necessary license. A winery, for example, is specifically authorized to obtain a full on-premises license if they want to sell distilled spirits. They cannot do it under their winery license. We have brew pubs, for example, that are allowed to sell beer that they manufacture on their premises, and they can also obtain, again, the full on-premises license to sell distilled spirits. But they can't sell distilled spirits without obtaining the full on-premises.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. But on that same point, just you were talking in your testimony that it didn't necessarily require that the on-premise distilling location be utilized, that it could be just an off-premise. Uh-huh. So as it relates to beer and wine products, and I don't know that any would exist, but under current law, could a brewery not manufactured in not manufactured in Oregon,
uh-huh.
you know, talking about, you know, the even deal here, uh-huh. if a Budweiser, I don't know, maybe they are, let's say Miller,
uh-huh.
Not manufactured in Oregon anywhere, could they under current law have a tasting room under current law?
We do have some distinctions between Chairman Metzger and we do have some distinctions between breweries and brew pubs, for example. A brew pub license sells beer that is manufactured on its licensed premises. The brewery does have to sell to consumers also only beer that is produced on its licensed premises in order to have an exception. Again, because both of these provisions that allow the on-premises sales are exceptions from the general Tied House rule that would prohibit a manufacturer from also selling to consumers. So the exceptions tend to be fairly narrowly drawn.
Okay, I'm not sure I got my answer.
I believe they can only sell the product that's brewed on the premises.
Okay. So would this then establish in your mind a distinction, a difference with this bill because of the point that you pointed out?
It is broader in that it's not limited to the products that are made on the Oregon
okay.
distillery.
All right. Other questions at the moment? Yeah, Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of a comment, or I guess it's a question. The concern that I would have is that the OLCC Commission is enacting by rule many of these things, and I guess the hope is that, and I'm reading your testimony and trying to discern what is statutory, what is constitutional, and what is done by rule.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just be very concerned anything that would be done by rule by the OLCC or its commission. A good example is what's happening with the Oregon Brew Fest right now.
Mm-hmm.
Not allowing, it's been a big event. A constituent of mine runs it, and it's been a big event with very little, if
mm-hmm.
any, violations at all.
Mm-hmm.
And OLCC came in by rule and without any real complaint or cause of problem
mm-hmm.
and took children out of the what is, I'm told, an international event. And so
mm-hmm.
I guess I would just put that comment, Mr. Chair, on the record is that on this issue and so many others, I think I would be concerned about anything that's done by rule by OLCC at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Chairman Metzger and Senator Deckard. If I could just respond, I think that was an interpretation of a statutory requirement, but it's obviously an interpretation and something that can be taken a look at.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Under this legislation, as you read it, could the distiller
mm-hmm.
in these rooms in which they're serving by the drink, could they sell the product by the bottle there directly? Like you can buy a wine at a similar...
Chair Metzger, that would not be the intention of this bill because it is for on-premises consumption, so it's only for consumption at the tasting or... lounge location. It is possible for distilleries to obtain an agent agreement so that they can sell their product by the bottle. that's a separate provision, they would be entering into the same type of contract that our liquor agents that operate liquor stores do to sell their product by the bottle. But that's what we call off-premises consumption. In other words, that's to be consumed off of the licensed premises. This bill is dealing with on-premises consumption, which is alcohol that's being consumed by patrons at that location. They're drinking it there by the drink.
Okay. Thank you. Jim, can you come up just one more moment, please? I'd like to... You can stay here, Donna, just in case before we wrap this up. Again, and I'll have you state your name for the record.
Jim Bendis from Bendis Distillery.
Jim, Ms. Vandals brought up the point that there seems to be one difference here, and that you wouldn't that under this bill, with even as amended, that you wouldn't necessarily have to operate a for sale by the drink at your distillery, and could choose just to have a single off-premise location, and that that is different than what we currently have for, you know, brew pubs. Was that an intention, or is that a modification? I'm just looking for consistency here with these laws.
I think we're looking for consistency, and my understanding was that the bill would allow us to sell by the drink as a restaurant, and if this is the same topic, and there is a provision that we could get a license to sell by the bottle also. As far as selling other brands, as a full on-premise license, a full on-premise license allows you to sell whatever brands you would like. And we certainly like to sell in our sampling room, a martini bar. We like to sell Pendleton whiskey because it's made in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
We like to mix cocktails that involve other brands that we think are premium. And as the industry grows, we would love to sell other brands in our on-premise location that are made by other micro distilleries in Oregon.
But then you would not have any concern about, if this bill were enacted, that a distiller not based in Oregon use the provision to open a the off-premise location for their Crown Royal or whatever.
I'm not. I mean, I don't know that I looked at or put a lot of thought into that. It doesn't bother me as a business person. That it's more open.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. What we're going to do is I kind of want to just noodle that provision, because one of the issues that we get with some of the OLCC stuff is because of conformity. And if we're going to do something, I'd be really concerned about making sure that we don't have someone come back 2 years and need to reconform.
Right.
And so we've also asked legislative counsel to come sometime during the course of this meeting, because the gentleman who wrote this bill is in another committee meeting, so we can have Senator Starr's question answered. So we'll bring the bill back and probably even in the course of this meeting, at least to have that question answered. So with that, thank you very much. We'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 451. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 425. And ask that Senator Farioli come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I would particularly like to thank the chair for allowing this bill to be heard. I'd like to tell the committee members a little story, if I might. I know legislators love to be told stories, because I've heard 1,000 of them myself. Back in the last legislative session, a group of very earnest people came to the legislature with House Bill 2656. And they pled a pretty strong case, and that case was that year after year, session after session, folks had to come to this legislature and ask for dollars for research and development and marketing and other needful purposes for cattle ranching and the raising of beef and pasturage and marketing of, the thing that's that is always for dinner, because Oregon is a tremendous producer of livestock. And legislators, even though many of them have a natural antipathy to raising taxes, when faced with the united request by commodity producers, we're generally pretty willing to allow those commodity producers to go ahead and get their increases, because after all, they're paying the tax. And so we did levy an additional 50 cents on the beef checkoff, but we were very specific in what we were authorizing. We said that of this 50 cents, 10 cents for each head of cattle assessed would be expended in funding selected research projects related to rangeland. And that 10 additional cents would, for each head of cattle be assessed, would be expended for research projects related to cattle production. And that an additional 10 cents of the 50 cents levied would be for funding projects to promote and project a positive image of the beef and dairy producers' operations. And that an additional 10 cents would be assessed for carrying out the council activities, the beef council activities. And that the final remaining 10% would be 10 cents would be expended by the council for administrative costs to carry out the programs. So not only did we earmark 40 cents for projects on the ground, but an additional 10 cents for administrative overheads. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, one of the proudest and best traditions of governance is that taxes are essentially levied with the consent of the governed. And when I returned back from the legislative session, I heard from a lot of people who indicated that they had not given their consent, nor had they even been aware. It's one of those axioms that people carry away as one of the essential truths. No person's property is safe nor life secure so long as the legislature's in session. So these folks didn't even know that they had a new tax on their per head assessments until it came time to sell their cattle. So I got a lot of negative feedback about that. And they asked me to draft the bill before you today, and that's Senate Bill 425. Essentially, it's just a repeal of the 50 cents. Now, here's where the thing gets interesting. In preparation for this committee, I asked Legislative Fiscal to be able to help me understand how much of the 50 cents had gone that we'd assessed and collected had actually been expended for research in rangeland production and cattle breeding and promotions for beef and livestock in the dairy industry, and how much went for administration. They can't tell me. They indicated that there's no way to track that once we've made this authorization to the agency. It just sort of disappears into the Beef Council. And the information I have anecdotally, at least, is that none of these earmarks have been honored. So, Mr. Chairman, the way I look at this is that if this agency, the Beef Council, hasn't been using the 50 cents for research and development and food processing and safety and marketing and administration, and that I can't verify it, that I would ask this committee, if they would please, to use its legislative oversight authority and ask the commission to come forward and show this committee and the legislature where the 50 cents has gone, where the aggregate assessment has been expended, because I can't find it. And use your authority as a legislative watchdog and do a mini audit. Simply make the request for the commission to show where the money has gone. And I would suggest, and I certainly hope I'm wrong in this regard, that the money's actually gone to exactly the places that we suggested or authorized and gave not only authority but limitation to the commission to spend this money, but hasn't gone there. I would suggest that we have another question that we need to ask. If they're not using the money for the purpose authorized by law, perhaps they didn't need it to begin with. So that's the question I'm asking you is, in this process of hearing Senate Bill 425, that you use your legislative authority to be watchdogs and provide some oversight to this agency. I think it needs it. And I want to be proven wrong. I want to be able to go back to my colleagues in the legislature and said, you voted to put 50 cents additional assessment into the law, and you authorized that that 50 cents be spent in this particular way, and by golly, that's what happened. I'm afraid you're going to find out that's not what happened.
Okay, Senator, a question. Senator Moss-Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know if the Beef Council has a regular audit an internal audit by an external group?
Mr. Chairman, madam, I do not know that. I know that, like every agency or institution that we authorize and fund, the ultimate responsibility for whether the agency follows the law is ours.
Well, just follow up. It just seems appropriate, I would think, to at least have the council do their own audit to try to track this down first. But then I'm not sure how they process things.
Well, Madam, Mr. Chairman, Senator Monis Anderson, I would be very happy to come back before this committee and apologize publicly to the Beef Commission and everybody involved with it if it's demonstrated that the dollars actually went where they're supposed to. And I'm hoping that we can ask that question. I intend to pursue it. I think probably the fastest way to get the best answer is to hold the commission, you know, invite them to come testify before the committee, and then we'll get to the bottom of this. If I'm wrong, by golly, I'll be happy to apologize.
Thank you. Senator, I know staff has contacted a couple people with Oregon Beef Council, Nicole Bechtel and Dean Jennings. Have you had contact with them about your questions?
Yes, my staff's been looking for the information.
And they were, to characterize, I think, your testimony, that they were unresponsive to being able to tell you how the money had been expended.
Yeah, I haven't had the
They're not signed up on the list today.
Mr. Chair, to close the loop with my staff, and I know my staff's trying to close the loop with their staff. So.
Okay, all right. All right, thank you. Thank you very much. Any other questions for the Senator?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Again, you are a busy person. The committee all are busy people. I really appreciate the effort that you put into this.
Thank you. We're just going to spend a few minutes here. I have a number of people signed up, and we may not get to everyone today if that's not necessary. So I will, our protocols, people who have come a long ways, we will ask to testify. And so I have Pat Sullivan and Elaine Smith, who have both signed up to testify, who say they have come from more than 100 miles for today's meeting. So I'll ask them to come forward.
Thank you. My name is Pat Sullivan. I'm from Hereford. I'm a cattle rancher up there. I guess I'm kind of new to this, so bear with me.
It's okay. That's right. Tell us what you think.
You know, I'm here to support 425 as it's written. And I've got to admit, I'm supposed to be looking for new reasons to support this thing other than my complaints about the last bill. But I got to admit, 75% of my support for this bill is because I hated the last one. Yet there is a couple of things in this bill that I think is going to be that are also good. I think that the way that the senator changed the wording from shall to may. It seemed to me like that was a sticking point when we were trying to fight this thing through the administrative rule process. I think by changing that put it into a permissive form, it gives control to Beef Council and gives us a little control to deal with an oversight if we, like most of it, didn't know about this bill when it passed originally. And then I think the second thing that really has me concerned about the additional 50 cents is I'm concerned that it isn't taken away from the original 50 cents that we're paying the Beef Council for promotion. You know, I mean, and I haven't talked to these people to find out how they're handling this additional workload, but common sense tells you that, and I know that they haven't added staff, common sense tells you that they've got four more programs to handle. They haven't made days any longer. And they haven't added staff, so I'm guessing something's got to give somewhere. And the promotion end of our beef promotion, the Beef Promotion Act, is very near and dear to me. I think it should be what we uphold. And I guess with those, that's really about the only thing I can say. I do want to both thank you guys and apologize to you for having to deal with this again. I know you had to deal with this once, and I think that probably if I hadn't slept through this process in the last legislative session where the original bill was passed, I think I might have been able to be here, and we might have got this thing stopped before we got had to come back. So,
thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Thank you for taking the time to come.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and for the record, I'm Elaine Smith, a rancher from Prairie City, Oregon, 30597 North River Road. I'm in support of SB 425, which in effect repeals HB 2656, passed in July of 2005. HB 2656 was passed without the majority of Oregon cattle producers' knowledge, and since the producer is the one forced to pay the tax, we certainly should have had an opportunity to vote on an increase and provide input in the event the increase was voted in. Because of our grave concerns regarding the way this was passed without our knowledge, I researched the requirements for notice of intended rulemaking and found what I believe to be a complete lack of due diligence to implement these requirements. I've included our testimony, complete with attached reference material, that I presented to the HB 2656 rulemaking hearing held March 20th, 2006 in Portland, Oregon, at the Oregon Beef Council office. This testimony should inform you of our concerns with HB 2656. Our concerns are no less now than last March, and we hope that this increase in the Oregon Beef Checkoff is repealed. An interesting thing I found out while researching the notification requirements of the Oregon Beef Council, by law, OBC was to have compiled an interested parties list. Notice of actions affecting these interested parties was to be mailed to them. But in order to be on the list, you must request to be on it. Therefore, at the time of this hearing, there was one person on the list, Scott from Portland, Oregon. One would think that all checkoff payers should be on the interested parties list, since they're the ones that are funding this. I would suggest that Oregon Beef Council should have made more of an effort to see that producers were on the interested parties list. And if this had been done, we all would have received notice of HB 2656 in time to contact our state legislators of our opposition to an increase in the checkoff.
Thank you very, very much. Mm-hmm. I think you could go ahead and step down. We have three people signed up for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association and two from the Oregon Cattlemen's. I would ask Mr. Nelson, Mr. Cron, and Mr. Morrison maybe decide who would like to testify on behalf of the Oregon Dairy Farmers, and Ms. Livingston and Mr. Welsh, who would like to testify from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, to go ahead and come forward. Well, it looks like you got the short straw. Thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, the Cattlemen's Association are proceeding all in the interest of time. If you desire, I'll go right ahead.
Please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Nelson, representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. The Oregon Dairy Farmers Association did in 2005 support House Bill 2656. And went through a scenario that went kind of like this. The Oregon Dairy Farmers Association has supported an increase in the Beef Council checkoff for at least 10 years that I know. I've been representing them since 1992 or so. And they have been very supportive of the projects and the programs of the Oregon Beef Council, and did support the increase in the checkoff in the 2005 session. We were not enamored with the specificity that was included in that law, and I think you can find people who were not enamored with any law you pass. But nonetheless, we thought that it should be more flexible for the Beef Council to make policy choices in the use of the money that was to be coming their way. However, we were assured by the Oregon Cattlemen's Association that in early January at a board meeting that the Cattlemen's Association were on board with the increase in the 50-cent or the 50-cent increase in the check offer and the assessment rate, but that the only way that they were really going to be supportive of it was with the specificity that Senator Farioli indicated earlier. And so with that in mind, we supported that specificity inclusion in the bill and went forward with our support as we had supported an increase in the assessment for in the years gone by. We do oppose just an absolute repealer of Senate Bill, or do oppose Senate Bill 425, an absolute repealer of that 50 cents, and that there are many, many things that we have hoped that would be accomplished with that money for on behalf of the dairy industry as well as the beef cattle industry. Since its passage, as you are hearing today, that has been embroiled in controversy in the beef cattle industry, not in the dairy industry. The dairy industry provides about 20% of the funding for the Beef Council through the sale of dairy animals at auction and other sales into the meat industry. We have provided an amendment which I don't think does what we intended to do, but that would be to say to you that if you intend to roll back the assessment to last to 2 years ago level, that is to do away with the 50 cent increase, our position would be, would you leave that 50 cent increase on dairy animals sold in the state of Oregon? The Department of Agriculture easily can make that distinction, and then direct that money to the Oregon Dairy Products Commission, which is a commodity commission not unlike the Oregon Beef Council. It operates under the auspices of the Department of Agriculture, and redefine the uses that are permitted for that money so the Oregon Dairy Products Commission can proceed with the programs that would be beneficial to the dairy industry. I'd like to, and I'll give you a copy of an email that I just received from incoming President Jerome Rosa, and if I might just read you a paragraph out of that, Mr. Chairman, to indicate his interest in this. First, Jerome Rosa is one of the dairy industry's two members on the Beef Council, but he makes it very clear that these are not comments as a Beef Council commissioner. But he does go on to say, and he's an organic dairy producer in the Jervis area. The new 50 cents that is the root of the hearing has the ability to do tremendous amount of good for the dairy and beef producers in Oregon. Not only is the additional legislative effort, but it's needed education and, in my case, research efforts as an organic dairy. And I'm reading the last paragraph. Currently, there is not much being done in Oregon on this front. Conventional dairy and beef producers, along with their organic counterparts, are searching for solutions to problems on the farms without relying on hormones, herbicides, pesticides, antibiotics. Much work can be done with this new 50 cents. So you see kind of where the dairy industry is going with their support for the additional 50 cents. It's our estimate that within 10 years, approximately 50% of the dairy production in the state of Oregon will be organic dairy. We have a lot of advantages for that, an ability to open up new markets for dairy producers around the West, the Northwest, and so on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. I'll ask you, and I'll ask our next guest in a moment, but from your perspective, for the assessment that has been going to the people that you represent, the dairy, do you believe that those monies are being spent the way you intended them to do, or have you inquired about that as to...
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good question. I was surprised at Senator Farioli's representation that they could not explicitly define what they were using the money for. The original, there are three separate 50 cents in the dairy, in the beef checkoff process now. The first 50 cents goes to the National Beef Promotion Board. The second 50 cents, and this is again federally directed as I recall, stays in state for the Beef What's for Dinner program and other programs like that. And I think absolutely those funds are going for the purposes that they were identified for. The third 50 cents, I know they went through a request for proposals process and requested a variety of proposals and received a variety of proposals. which I watched that process. The final determination, I did not observe the final determination as to what those funds were, what projects were selected under that RFP process, but that has been probably just within the last 7 or 8 months that that's been taking place. So I can't tell you exactly what the decisions were.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's go to our next guest here.
I have copies of my testimony. Okay. My name is Sharon Livingston. I reside in Long Creek, Oregon. I am presently serving as president of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I'm going to make my testimony fairly brief because you have written testimony. House Bill 2656 was passed in 2005. It increased the beef checkoff. You've heard that. We felt that there were good reasons for doing that, and I will cite those. I will not tell you specifically which each 10 cents is being used for. You've heard it from Senator Farioli. It's in my testimony. Research is important, and it is important to the beef industry now as never before. Range land uses are viable needs for us in order for us to stay in business. The state of Oregon, over 50% of it, if I'm correct, and I believe I am, and I live in a county where 60% is managed by the public, owned by the public. Using those lands is important for our sustainability. We need research. With the environmental pressures, we must constantly be proving that what we do with public lands is the right thing to do. The only way we can do that is by research. Research is expensive. You know that our land grant college is seeing cuts, and we felt it was time for us to step up to the plate and do research. Animal science is on the move. The consumer is controlling a great deal of what we do. If we want to stay in business, we have to develop a product that's going to be saleable. We need research ongoing to do that. Organic, as you know, is becoming very popular. We need to know how to do that and still stay in business. Public image is extremely important. Again, we have pressures on us on a daily basis. I feel those phone calls to show that what we do is environmentally safe. I'm involved in a project where we bring children from the Sunnyside Elementary Environmental School in Portland, and they stay in our homes for 4 days, and we show them what we are doing. It's been a great experience. We're now in the second year of that. I would like to relate to you some of the things that we did to let people know that we were moving forward on the 50 cents. I want to emphasize that we still believe it is good for the beef industry, and I pay that 50 cents. Outreaches, articles in 10 issues of the Oregon Beef Producer, our trade magazine, from November 2004 to February 2006 were mailed to our members. We know that we have a letter signed by people stating they knew nothing about it. 8 of those people that signed the letter are part of our membership. We talked about it at 11 County Livestock Association meetings from November 2004 to February 2006. Many non-OCA members were present. We provided information on House Bill 2656 at all of our quarterly meetings. We have agendas posted on our website, published in the Oregon Beef Producer, and sent out with press releases about the meetings. We sent out emails to contact lists requesting input on House Bill 2656. We talked to the press about House Bill 2656. The Capitol Press alone published 8 articles from December 2005 till January 2006 about the checkoff increase. I mentioned to you why we designated the 10 cents. We had people that said they would not support this. People not only in our own organization but outside that said they would not support it unless we did some designating as to how to use the money. That's why we did it. At this time, we are forming some industry research committees that will work very closely with the Beef Council in consulting, and it states that in the 2656 that the Beef Council will consult with representatives of the industry, not just Oregon Cattlemen's Association members, but other people. We expect those groups to be very actively involved with the Beef Council, and we will move forward in seeing that that's done. I'd like for you to know that organic farming is very important. Some of us have used manure as an organic fertilizer, and now there is a move to make manure a toxin pollute. And if that happens, think what will happen to organic farming. And I know you people in this area use that. So we're involved in that fight. Air pollution, beef health, safety issues, all of those are important to us, and we feel we need the research to back that up. You must understand that even though the law was passed, we did not begin to collect the money until July. I believe that if you go to the Beef Council, you will find that they have monies collected. They did not fully fund all of the authorization requests. Anytime a law is implemented, there are going to be challenges. There will be challenges in carrying out House Bill 2656. We are dedicated to accepting those challenges and moving forward with it. And I believe you should visit with the Beef Council. You should find out where the money is. And I think that you will find out that at least most of it is there, and they are still accepting authorization requests, and we will be very involved in how that money is spent. All people in the industry. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Livingston. According to your written testimony, that the collection didn't begin until July
of 2006. Excuse me, I was in 2006.
Yeah,
so
okay.
We've only been at this for a little over 6 months. I don't think the bill that was passed in the 2005 legislation has had an opportunity to work. I'd like to see that happen. We are opposing Senate Bill 425 for those reasons.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions for Senator George and Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Sharon, either one of you guys can answer this for me. Obviously, within agriculture, marketing orders are somewhat controversial. I mean, I think that's stated. And in fact, I've posed marketing orders in industries that I've been involved in, but at the same time, I've served on the Hazelnut Marketing Board. So I've served on both sides. The complaint that people were not notified is always a very, very concern to me, big concern to me, because of the fact that these things are so controversial within our industries. And so when anybody says they haven't heard it, I'm always very concerned about that. Is there any way that there can be better notification on these things, especially within your industry, the Department of Ag? Because to me, this kind of legislation right here is very divisive in our industries that are already under attack or under assault from markets and world markets. And I really am sympathetic to people who say, hey, I didn't know about this, because they're producers and they're out there trying to produce. So I would like to see us engaged a little bit more on that, and maybe you could respond a little bit broader to that.
Could I say this, and without being facetious, laws are passed in Salem every day that affect me as a livestock producer, and I don't always know about them until after it happens. I'm not saying that anyone's wrong, but that's the way it is. I am on your, and have been for many years. I used to receive reams of paper before I could get on the Internet, and I sign up to get hearings of bills to know what's going on. I also depend on my legislators. Basically, when they have time, they send out newsletters. Anything they send out, I respond to. I belong to probably 7 organizations in this state, and I think you have to stay involved in trade organizations of all diverse groups, not just your own livestock industry. I operate a business. I take the time to do that.
Quick follow-up, if I could.
Yes.
I'm guessing both your organizations that this was not a unanimous vote to support the previous legislation. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, in the dairy industry, I don't know if you could say it was unanimous or that there was not much opposition. And the process that we went through, both at conventions in newsletters and publications, and then we have a series of regional meetings at which, you know, first of all, let me say that of the 375 dairy producers in the state, 373 of them are members of the association. And of that of that number, approximately 95% of them came to one of 10 regional meetings around the state because it was a free dinner. So they heard. They heard
is that where the money's being spent?
They heard the discussion. Maybe it was because of the free lunch that they didn't offer opposition. But that was. We went through a rather elaborate process and have done that for a number of years to say we're supporting this and hope it's coming. And there was not opposition. There was maybe one or two people, obviously. But I think the real answer to your question is would probably make campaigning a lot easier. How do you get a message into people's minds? It's just very, very difficult to get attention and to cause people to read materials that you send to them. We're down to we work at that very hard in associations to try to get the message on the stamp or on the envelope or the return address or something like that so it says open this and read it. It's very, very difficult.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This was just a follow-up on that. You said that there were 375 dairy farmers. How many cattle farmers are there?
Livestock, beef livestock producers.
Beef stock producers.
I don't know. Sharon, have you got that number?
We're told that it's 9,000, and we understand that we do not have a majority. However, we do reach all the people that we can. Okay. We use the Capital Press. The Capital Press is widely spread.
Of that 9,000, I might add, just to bolster that up, if you go down through Western Oregon, that includes all of the people like me who had a cow out in the 20 acres, I used to be a member of the Cattlemen's Association years ago, but when I sold my cow, well, I discontinued it. But.
Okay, well, so I'm trying to get down to figures here. So there are 375 dairy farmers, and what's the average number of cattle that a dairyman has, and what's the average number of cattle that a cattleman has?
Average number, asked Jim Cron to do some quick math in the back. He's the director of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. There are approximately, I'm going to round number this, at approximately 140,000 dairy cows when you include Three Mile Canyon Farms at Hermiston, which is about, 40,000. They range, 40 to 50,000 animals, including producing cows on through calves and so on. So total number of cows, that divided by the 375 or so would be...
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, a lot.
400.
400, okay.
373.
Okay.
400.
Not a calculator. Okay.
and then for...
I don't have a number for you. I will get one.
But, if we have 140,000 dairy cattle, I was just wondering how many thousands of cattle, beef-producing cattle, do we have?
I will want to be specific. I will let you know that. Don't want any room. I don't deal in rumors. I would rather deal in fact, and I will get that for you.
Okay. If there's someone that knows that, I can write it down on a piece of paper and bring it over.
Me and the head of big cows.
Okay, if you're going to speak, I have to have you come forward. I can't have you sit in the back of the room. It's okay, but people, come on forward. Because people at home can't see who you are, and we want to know your expertise on the airways here. If you identify yourself, and thank you for your taking a moment.
Senator Metzger, my name is Coy Calvert. Okay. I'm immediate past president of the Oregon Cattlemen. I have also been on the Beef Council for a total of 6 years and no longer a member. But according to the, and forgive me for answering the way that I did.
No. Not your fault.
I saw that the senator really needed to know the numbers. And according to USDA figures, and I can furnish you and the president can with booklets to those, but there is basically a million head of beef cattle in the state of Oregon, and the Beef Council collects about $450,000 to $500,000 per year, which would be a dollar, before the 50 cents would be a dollar per head.
Okay.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
You guys sit down. I'm going to just managing our time here a little bit with people that have other things to do. I am, just for a few minutes, going to close up here in 4:25. We're going to come back, though, in about 3 minutes, and return so that other people can get back to work by reopening the public hearing on Senate Bill 451 and ask Dave Hendricks and our representative from the OLCC to come forward because we had some questions. I'd like them to get back to work. So take the opportunity while they're available. And welcome, Mr. Hendricks. If you'd done very sure for the record, and the question that we had from Senator Starr was about the effective date of the original bill and with the amendment and how that might affect things.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, special counsel to legislative counsel. The bill has one effective date, January 1st of 2008. There are no special operative dates attached to any of the provisions, so all of the bill becomes effective, including amendments, on January 1st of 2008.
So is that so the language of the original bill is basically superfluous to say that it would take effect? I mean,
Yes. Normal effective date in the absence of any stated effective date is January 1st of the following year.
Okay, thank you.
So what the effective date applies to is licensee holders. So whether they have their license, get their license, it's retroactive on existing license holders. That's what Section 3 means, right?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, the changes that we make in the two sections that are in the bill specifically indicates it's going to apply to all distillery licenses, whether issued before, on, or after the effective date of the act, so it would pick up those changes for everybody. The changes on the brew pub license that appear in the amendment don't appear in that list, but they are going to be limitations. They were limitations on the ability of those licenses to sell certain things. I think that it'll probably be fine. I doubt if there'd be a problem with saying that.
Prospectively. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, thank you, Senator Starr, on that. Was there further discussion about the other question at all in terms of whether breweries, wineries, in these circumstances would be treated differently under the legislation as amended, should it pass with the distilleries? Or is there anything new to contribute since that discussion while we're here?
Mr. Chairman, I think that each of the statutes is worded a little bit differently. Some of them have some size limitations and things of that nature in terms of who can get a different type of license, for example. But I don't think, aside from trying to go back and get all the statutes to read exactly the same way, that that's something that we can address to get 100% uniformity.
Well, does the department have any particular angst with that as amended? You, your testimony seemed to answer those issues for you. And
mm-hmm. No, we don't have particular concerns with the amendment, no.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thanks for taking time to come back up. Once again, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 451. We're going to return to the public hearing on Senate Bill 425. And the last two people I have signed up, and we'll bring them up together, is Margene, if you want to come forward, and then also Coy, Terry Coward. Please. Welcome.
Ready. Thank you, Senator. Senator Metzger and committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify today. I am Margene Guerin. I'm Secretary of Oregon Livestock Producer Association. We are a grassroots cattle organization in Oregon. I'd like to commend Mr. Nelson and Mrs. Livingston for their comments on HB 2656. And I think Mr. Nelson's idea that the Dairy Association has brought up regarding directing funds to, I can't remember the name of the organization, he said that his dairy folks wanted to direct funds to, but to help with the organic milk a promotion, etc., is an excellent idea. And I appreciate Sharon's comments on the importance of promoting beef and educating folks about beef and all the research that needs to be done. But there are serious flaws and problems with HB 2656, and that's why we are here today in support of Senator Ferrioli's Senate Bill 425, and we thank him for introducing this bill to repeal 2656. One thing I would like to point out is the simple fact that the majority of folks, when we learned of the increase in the checkoff, which we learned about after the fact, I guess you can call us uninformed if you like, but all of the folks that are here today, we belong to three national cattle organizations, two national cattle organizations actually, to RCAF USA, to the Oregon Competitive Markets, which is the think tank on cattle organization issues, and to our state Oregon Livestock Producer Association. And I'm also the membership co-chair for the National Committee for RCAF USA, and I am the Oregon membership chair for RCAF in the state of Oregon. I receive three trade papers on the industry. I read the Capital Press. I am pretty affluent on the internet, and I did not know about this beef checkoff increase. So anyway, I'm going to skip some of the comments because they've already been made to you, but I do want to, and I will try to be brief here for the sake of time. I know that this is necessary, but I have some comments here that I think are important about why we support 425. There was gross mischaracterization of the support to Oregon legislators by sponsors of the bill to suggest overwhelming support by Oregon cattle producers. There is great concern also over the 10 cents allocated for lobbying in the law. And quoting Jim Wilson, who is an Oregon Beef Council member, in his testimony before the rulemaking hearing on March 20th of 2006, he states, "The thing that makes me the most nervous about this whole deal is the funding that is available for lobbying. And that's what keeps it separated from federal dollars, and it's the one thing that this bill allows for that the federal dollars don't. I think lobbying is a real dangerous road to go down with checkoff dollars. The checkoff fund was not set up that way originally. It was purposely written that way in the federal law, and to me, I think what we're doing is setting ourselves up for a lot of divisiveness in the future, and in this one little area, because what this allows us to do is lobby an effort for maybe one faction of the industry to lobby for the rest of the checkoff payers who may not be in favor of such a lobby. And you're getting into political things there, and I don't think are healthy for our industry for everyone's money to be used for that. I think it is a real dangerous path to go down." The increase also was sold to OCA members as being a backup revenue source for the Oregon Beef Council when it was feared that the Supreme Court would strike down the federal Beef Checkoff Act in order. But you would think after the federal checkoff was not struck down that perhaps they would have rescinded this increase. That wasn't the case. And actually, the state money that they already had, the 50 cents, was exempt from the federal act and order under Section 2910, so there wasn't a danger of them losing that 50 cents. With regard to the administration of monies collected, Bob Forth, who was a member, former two-term Oregon Beef Council member, this is what he said in his testimony at the rulemaking hearing. He said, I'm submitting this testimony in opposition to Oregon Beef Council's adoption of the administrative rules as presented for the 50 cents a head checkoff. If the administrative rules are adopted the way they are proposed, this is going to be an administrative nightmare. Then, this is a very interesting addition. Tom Ramey, who is the chief financial officer of the Cattlemen's Beef Board, which is part of the national program, states in the letter that he wrote to the Oregon Beef Council, I would suppose in correspondence with them over HB 2656, and Stephen Wolf, who testified at the hearing, referenced Mr. Rainey's comments in his testimony. He said this is what Mr. Rainey told the Oregon Beef Council. He said, number one, I asked the Oregon Beef Council to reject the administrative rules as set forth in HB 2656. The administrative and accounting procedures are going to be monumental. The 10 cents from the new 50 cents probably will not cover these costs, but if they do now, it probably won't be long before they will be inadequate. When that happens, and it will, what then? You have no options as set forth in the administrative rules. And number two, the Oregon Cattlemen's Association plans to use some of the money to retain legal counsel for litigation. The OCA's interpretation of ORS 577-290-1C could be like President Bush's interpretations of the Homeland Security Act as far as electronic eavesdropping is concerned.
Orjean, I'm sorry. I want to get to everybody's opportunity here, so I'm going to ask you, you say you have written testimony, so please
I do. Could I have just 1 minute to...
Yes, then we're going to go to Scarra, and then we have to move on to some other
things. One thing that why we have these problems with the way that HB 2656 was set up, we would offer some solutions, much as Mr. Nelson had suggested, directing money toward a program that could be helpful to producers. And what we say is that whether Senate Bill 425 passes or HB 26 remains or is amended, one thing that must be included in the provision of the law is that it must be voted on by the payers of the assessment. And also, any new increase should be voluntary and directable. And the payers of this tax could direct funds either to the Oregon Beef Council or they could direct these funds to their county court. And the funds directed to the county would be held in a special account and managed by a board appointed by the county court with county government oversight. And those funds would be used to the benefit of payers for issues as grazing, water, or other private property. And these were would all be issues that would need to be worked out. But this is something that we think could be feasible and helpful to cattle producers.
Thank you very much.
And I will submit.
Thank you. First submit.
Thank you.
Submission. Everybody will get a copy of that. Scarra, I'm sorry, I only have a few minutes.
That's okay.
I do want to hear from you.
Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I am. My name is Terry Cowart. My family owns and operates a livestock auction yard in Lebanon, Oregon. I am also a member of the Oregon Beef Council. I cannot speak on behalf of the Beef Council, but I can answer some questions about the process and what happened. The question arose earlier if there was an audit. There is an audit. There is two audits. There's one by the state of Oregon. There's one by the federal order, which would be the CBB, which Marjean spoke about. The portion of the 50 cents, there's 10 cents for five portions. The first portion, let's take as rangeland, there was 10 cents put into that. We estimated an approximate budget of $84,000 for rangelands. We estimated approximately $84,000 budget for animal science, $84,000 for producer image, $84,000 for studying legislation, and $84,000 for administration. Currently, there has been not 1 cent spent for rangeland or for animal science research. We have collected that money since July 1. It is in a fund. We are currently forming two committees, one for rangeland and one for animal science, four members of the Oregon cattle industry, two members from the Oregon dairy industry, and two members from Oregon State University. We have asked the Oregon Cattlemen's Association to give us a list of people that they would like to form on a set on the committee. They have done that. We've asked the Oregon livestock producers
Association to give us a name for someone to set on the committee. As of this time, they have not done that yet. So we're trying to make a broad representation of everybody for that committee. Senator Ferriolo's testimony struck me as being really off guard. That information on our budget is available. It is public information. We are, in a way, a state agency, and so, or a state identity. So that budget is available for view. The budget is put out for comment. We've not had an audit on the new 50 cents yet because it's not time for an audit. We only collected from July. We've spent some of the money from the positive producer image. We have spent a little of the money for administration, and we have spent a little of the money for studying legislation. The Beef Council could not comment on this legislation prior to this new bill. We never had the opportunity due to the federal regulations that kept us from commenting on legislation. So the new bill gives us a position where we can take that. We'll have a Beef Council meeting September 19th. We'll take a position. We may or may not take a position as a Beef Council on this, the new bill coming up. My family's operation, we sell between 15 and 25,000 cattle a year annually. Through the market, about another 10,000 cattle on the outside. We come in contact with a minimum of 100 sellers per week. I get no negative comment from my people in my sale barn about the new 50 cents. We have to have money to move forward. We cannot compete globally with people that make 18 cents an hour and with people that take $10 or $5 and put towards their budget. They'll put $5 an animal in some countries towards their budget to promote their product. We put $1.50 now. And so I could sure answer some questions from the Beef Council side if you folks had any.
Well, I think what we'll do, Mr. Carr, thank you very much. And I'm sure some of our members remember some of these discussions when Welcome to the World of Commodity Commissions, and where we have private industry that, you know, comes to the legislature and asks us to help them have opportunity to market, and we always have these discussions, and they're valuable. But it's almost like mediating the family, so to speak, and it's sometimes very difficult. I think what we're going to do at this point...
Mr. Chairman, one more comment, please. There's about 18,000 brand holders in the state of Oregon. And a brand holder would be somebody that maybe necessarily did or did not own animals, but had a registered brand, mm-hmm. a hot iron brand or electric brand that you'd brand your animals with. Some farms may have multiple brands. Some farms may have no brands. There is no real number of how many livestock or cattle producers are in the state of Oregon. So therefore, with the dairy industry, which I work very closely with, there's 345 or whatever the estimated number was there. With 18,000 people, as just take the registered brand holders, it's very difficult to get that information to 18,000 people. You're bound to find some that did not get it through due diligence or whatever. Right. You know, and we as a Beef Council could not come forward and promote this. We didn't. The cattle industry, the dairy industry came forward. They did the promoting of this bill, and they did as good a job as they could do to name 18,000 people. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, I thank you. I appreciate your time. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone who came to testify. And we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 425. Let's see.
Thank you.
What I'm going to do is open a public hearing on Senate Bill 440, and I'm going to ask that Diane Belt, Ron Northcraft, Don Miner come forward. You're all signed up in support of 440. I'm going to ask Janet to explain the bill. We'll try to be expeditious with our time, so we might be able to do something with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 440 requires additional information be included on ownership documents for manufactured homes and requires that a seller document to the county that tax and assessment payments are current at the time of notice of sale. The -1 amendments were brought to clarify who is responsible for providing the additional information about the structure to the on the title document. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Welcome. I'll let you decide who would like to start.
Well, I guess it's me. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Diane Belt. I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I'm also the tax collection supervisor for Washington County. And this has been quite an afternoon, from martinis to beef, and now we're going to talk about manufactured homes. This is exciting.
Well, you can, you know, share the two inside the manufactured home.
Well, we have a little barbecue martini out in the park. Sounds good. I just real quickly, because I know you're really stressed for time here, we're going to be talking about what we call the LOAS system. And in 2001, a work group was appointed that looked at the manufactured housing industry and how these homes were titled and ownership was procured, and it was done through the Department of Motor Vehicles. So basically, the 2003 session picked all of the processing from the Department of Motor Vehicles and moved it over to DCBS, Department of Consumer and Business Services, and that was Senate Bill 468, which was, I think, 624 pages. So, it was light reading one evening on Sunday. Lois Colson, the reason it got Lois Colson was worked with me, and I worked with her for many years, and she was very dedicated to trying to get some of the issues worked out with manufactured housing, and she worked really hard on this. Unfortunately, she passed away from cancer before 468 was passed and implemented, and I promised her that I would see this through and make it work. So that's one reason why we're here today, and that's why it's called Lois. Manufactured housing is considered personal property. It's not like real property, and it's always been very difficult to manage these types of properties. When the LOAS system went into effect, it was ultimately the county's responsibility to gather information, because most people come into our offices to transact business on manufactured homes. So it seemed logical that we would be the agency that people would come into to see, and we would be the agent of DCBS or building codes. One of the major things in the work group that we worked on and that we wanted was to gather supplemental information on these homes, like built-ins, purchase price, a lot of things to do about the home. It's very readily available for real property, but it is not for personal, and it's very hard to make an assessment on a manufactured home from the street. So one of the things in the work group that was very important to us was the supplemental information on these homes. During the crafting of 468, rather than make it 826 pages, we kind of talked about how we would capture this information, and it was decided to keep it extremely loose and use the rulemaking process to kind of fine-tune and hone what we were looking for. Lois started in May of 2005. It's been a little rocky, but things are up and running very well. But there has been some issues between DCBS and the stakeholders as to the supplemental information and how to collect it. And that's why we have Senate Bill 440 before you today. We want to make it a requirement on these manufactured homes so that we can begin to build a database. It's something that all stakeholders want and need. It's used to do appraisals. It's used in the banking industry. Dealers use it. It's something that we don't have as a state, state of California, state of Idaho, state of Washington. They're all able to give you a database or printouts of comparable sales and characteristics of the manufactured homes. One other thing that was kind of missed in 468 was a little tax issue. We want to protect the purchaser and the seller of these homes and guarantee that all property taxes are paid at the time of transfer. That got dropped in the bill, so we want to clean that up so that when somebody transfers ownership, it will not transfer without that tax liability being paid. Now, there are some amendments.
I have one amendment. Is this the one you refer to?
That's the
dash one.
Yeah, the dash one. One of the things that I see missing that's very important to me on the third page on line 13, and for whatever reason it got dropped, but it should say current levy year. If it says current year, then we'll be requiring a pre-collection of tax in some cases, and we don't want to do that. The other amendment, parts of the amendment didn't really have any problem with at all, but there might be some other issues. But in a nutshell, that's what Senate Bill 440 does, and I think I'll go ahead and let Ron kind of talk a little bit more about the appraisal side of it. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ron Northcraft from Roseburg, Oregon. I'm the past president of WSOCA, Oregon State Association of County Assessors. When the work group was formed in 2001, I became the assessor's representative to that group, and I've been involved in it immensely right from day one. Our interest is in getting the sales price, the sale date, and the physical information regarding that home so that we can be efficient in our office administration, so that we can have consistency in our assessment and full disclosure. One of the benefits is of having the information and disclosure is a reduction in state burden in backfilling the county school support. The amendments, the data that we're after has the support from all facets of the buyers and sellers and lenders of manufactured homes. The buyer and seller, they may not realize that it's necessary, but it helps when the data is out in the public. Prior to being assessor, I was an appraiser operating within our area for 26 years, and that data for manufactured homes is always hard to get. Having a central location for it to get into the county records just goes across all lines and helping all those different facets provide better service to the users. So we are in support.
And are you familiar with the amendment?
Yes, I am.
And are you supportive of that as well?
With the minor modification that Diane mentioned.
Okay, thank you. You probably notice we're in subcommittee now. Mr. Meyer, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. With the exception of the issue raised by Diane Belt, we can support the bill as written or the Dash 1 amendments. We had been working, though, with the Building Codes Division. They wanted to clarify in the bill that the retailer, the seller of the home, was responsible for providing this information. And our concern was that the dealer not be responsible for keying it into the system. The LOAS system is an electronic, an internet-based system. And you know, there are some very small dealers who aren't very adept at using it. Some very large companies, some manufacturers, have not, in all cases, been able to use the LOAS system successfully. It's the firewalls and things like that have gotten in the way. And as a practical matter, most of these transactions are processed by title companies. So we don't have a problem making it clear that the retailer must provide this information to the consumer or to someone designated by the consumer. We just want to make clear, though, that there be no requirement that dealer be required to key it into the system, because in many cases he's not the person charged with that responsibility. And with that, I would conclude my remarks, and thank you for allowing us to come before you.
Mr. Miner, is there anything in the bill that gives you heartburn in that regard?
It was an amendment that... And it was an amendment that had been circulating.
Okay.
That had created the heartburn.
One that I
did
not.
The bill itself does not.
You're not talking about the Dash 1, are you?
The Dash 1 works for us, except for the issue.
Yes.
We don't want the retailers to be in a position, or consumers, that when they sell their home, to not only pay this year's taxes, but next year's taxes in advance.
Okay.
I mean, that's something very burdensome. Used to be the law, and we don't want to return to that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Meyer. Questions? Any questions, Mr. Meyer? Okay, thank you very much. Joan Frazier, you want to come forward? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joan Frazier, and I'm the Deputy Administrator of the State Building Codes Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We had an amendment that we were trying to work on with Mr. Miner, actually, that...
Just the one he was referring to?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And our issue, which we believe is not addressed in the Dash amendments, is to clarify who is responsible as a source of the information. Our issue was not necessarily who was transacting the data. We have escrow people, we have title people, we have lenders, but they're all doing it on behalf of someone, and that would be the dealer or the seller. And so our amendments try to clarify that the dealer or the seller are actually responsible for the information. And we worked on some amendments that I believe we agreed to, but we were too late to get it to Legislative Council in time for this hearing, and that would actually talk about the clarification of responsibility and then allow that these other parties can transact within the system, which they do currently. So we would prefer, we would like to see those amendments the way they were originally written. If there were more time, if not, if you want to move this bill, then we'll continue the discussion over on the mm-hmm. House side.
Mr. Meyer, I'm a little confused. We want to come back up. She was talking to Ms. Frazier was talking about the responsible party. You're talking about, you know, the form of filing. She wasn't referring to that. I mean, where's our controversy here other than that?
Mr. Chair, Don Miner for your record. I don't believe there is a controversy. In the bill as drafted or in the dash one, it's the further clarification brought that about. It implied, at least, in my reading, that the retailer not only was responsible for providing the information, but keying it into the mm-hmm. system.
Okay, so that's so that is the only point, and that is not the issue that you're referring to as a problem.
Our issue that we want clear direction on who is responsible as a source of the information.
Okay, so what
I think we're in disagreement.
We're not in disagreement.
Okay, so then what I want to do is we have a one-word change. Levy, I believe, is the word that has to be inserted, and you would like the further clarifications that we have. That you two would be in agreement on, subject to looking at the language. I'm just trying to implore people. Some of these bills will not come back more than once or twice because we're getting very busy now. So this isn't like the old days where a few weeks later, I mean, I'm just saying in a couple weeks there is no more time. So I will ask that you get that done as promptly as possible, and we'll bring it back and try to move your bill for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 440. And let's see, do we have any of our members outside? We do have the quorum, but I'd just like to see if there's any members who we have a resolution and possible work session now on 451. I just want to see if they would have an opportunity to participate while we adjourn for the day.
We're not doing 167.
No, they have another amendment. You're all gone? Okay. All right. So what we're going to do here, we won't wait. Let's return to the public hearing on Senate Bill 451. And I can't remember, Senator George, you may have been out of the room at the time that we had Mr. Hendricks come in to clarify Senator Starr's answer, which was satisfactory. And
I got to hear that.
And you did. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my desire would be, I know we have support of the other two members who aren't here. If you're okay with that, I think we'll just go ahead and get the process going. So I'll close the public hearing, open work session, Senate Bill 451, and I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 451 to the
amendment.
We have the dash one.
I
move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 451.
Okay. Senator Montes Anderson has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 451. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
I move
Monica.
Senate Bill 451 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Montes Anderson has moved Senate Bill 451 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and we'll ask Senator Westland to carry the bill since it is his. And then, so we'll close that, and I'm going to open a work session on possible introduction of committee bills, and we have one resolution before us, and Janet, why don't you explain that?
Mr. Chair and members, this is the resolution that would indicate support for a joint Columbia River crossing project. The language at the end is for cooperation by state between public and private parties and the states of Oregon, Washington, and our federal delegations.
Thank you. And as this is the amendment that we're preparing jointly with our Washington counterparts when we will be meeting with them to adopt our mutual cooperation a week from Friday in Portland.
That'll be great.
So this is really a historic deal. And I would entertain a motion to introduce as a committee bill this resolution.
Mr. Chair, I move legislative concept 3150. Where does it go?
Be introduced as a committee bill.
Be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you very much, our committee resolution. Senator Montes Anderson has moved LC 3150 to be introduced as a committee resolution. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Okay, now, well, you want to just tell us briefly about Wednesday?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wednesday is a review of the Connect Oregon One process with the Chair of the Transportation Commission, Stuart Foster, and the Director of the agency. And the idea is to kind of hear how the projects went and status on those projects, as well as to talk about the process that led up to the selection of the process from the last legislature. And this was the $100 million in projects that went for non-highway projects around the state. And then the bill we have up on Wednesday has to do with medical marijuana and the how it affects the workplace and gives additional ability for an employer to restrict or challenge someone's effect on the job of their medical marijuana use.
Great, thank you. So it'll be a very interesting day. I would encourage members on the Connect Oregon Summit, I requested, because the bill's in the House, and I think there's just a lot of interest to make sure that should we go forward with a Connect Oregon 2, that the criteria for selection of the projects that people are comfortable with, because it's very possible it could bypass this committee and go straight to Ways and Means. So I want my committee members to have a chance to have input on it while it's on the House side. So if you have any questions about Connect Oregon or review what happened to Connect One, this is going to be our opportunity for those who made those decisions to be able to answer your questions about that, and so we can get input that we would be able to place into that bill. Okay? Thank you very much for your attendance. The committee's adjourned.